This show is sponsored by HexClad. You know, my kitchen is full of stainless steel pans that are hard to clean and nonstick pans that you have to replace like every 6 months. That is, it was full of those things until we found HexClad, which is a staple when we're cooking. They are fantastic. I am a big egg and pancake maker. Big pancake maker. That's like dinner 7 or 8 nights a week in my house, George. The kids will often with the old pans, cut them up, scratch them, nick them when they go to butter the pans. Not the HexClad. They last for forever. You see that old pan that's haunting your kitchen? It's time to give yourself what you really want. HexClad's pans are easy to clean, dishwasher safe, and simple to wipe clean after use. They're oven safe, handling heat up to 500 degrees. HexClad products also come with a lifetime warranty. They literally last a lifetime, and they're toxin-free. HexClad isn't just about pots and pans. Their knives are made of 67 layers of Japanese Damascus steel for a sharper edge that stays sharp longer for effortless slicing. Gordon Ramsay uses HexClad in his restaurants and his home. You guys all know that he is not easily impressed. For a limited time only, our listeners get 10% off your order with our exclusive link. Just head to hexclad.com/askgeorge. Support our show and check them out at hexclad.com/askgeorge. Make sure to let them know that we sent you. Bon appetit. Let's eat with HexClad's revolutionary cookware.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
She kept looking at him during the entire debate. She watched him while he was spewing out his insanity. She's not afraid of him. She shows contempt for him in a restrained way. That was a lot of the messaging that occurred. And then he would not look at her. He would just make these sourpuss looks because he was unhappy. He can't take the heat.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to George Conway Explains It All to Sarah. I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, and because I'm not a lawyer, I've asked my good friend George Conway from the Society for the Rule of Law to explain the legal news to me. George, I don't know, what is it about you? Do you look more famous? Is that what it is? You're fresh from your appearance on Jimmy Kimmel?
Oh, yeah. Give me Jimmy Kimmel. He's my bud.
What was that like? Why? And also, I'm sorry. This is a two-person show. Two-person show.
Oh, I'm sorry. Don't you have somebody? I did not actually meet your relative who works there.
My brother-in-law is a writer on Jimmy Kimmel. Somehow, I have a brother-in-law who's a writer. I have a podcast partner who goes on the show. Kinzinger was on the show.
Kinzinger was on the show last week. Yeah, they were almost going to ask me about gaseous emissions from the 45th president of the United States.
Kinzinger loves to talk about that. You know, yeah, this is why
to talk about that. He didn't do it at the Democratic National Convention, fortunately. But I was ready with a story. They said, "Do you know anything about this?" And I said, "Not directly and personally." And I was ready for a story, and I had a joke about it, but we didn't cover that, thankfully.
Normally, I would very much want to hear the cutting room floor story that you have.
Very clever.
Cutting, thank you.
Very good.
Thank
cutting,
you.
You know.
I did. I saw the pun. The pun wasn't exactly intended, but I heard it as it was coming out. I will say I do not like scatological stories or humor of any kind. So,
well, we don't like rumors of people eating scats. All right, enough dad puns for the day. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm done.
Okay, so fresh from Kimmel and fresh from the Texas Tribune.
Yeah, that seems like it was just like yesterday.
I know. We were together IRL with a bunch of podcast super fans who really, I swear to God, if we had just sat there and for 45 minutes, you'd been like, "Donald Trump is going to jail," over and over and over again. Yeah, they just would have sat there and been like, "Yeah!"
And there's like 10 minutes of applause. And soon the podcast is over.
It was like we started talking, you know, deep into the legal weeds, and I could see some people kind of being like, eh. And then I'd be like, so George, what's going to happen to Trump? You'd be like, he's going to jail. And everybody'd be like, yeah. All right.
It's still going to take a while, but we're getting there.
Well, we're going to do some legal analysis as we go.
Was there any law last week? Did anything happen?
Well, I'll tell you, I have some legal adjacent things that I really want to talk about later in the pod.
Okay.
All right. So one of the things I want to talk about, though, is the debate. Before we get into all that, because I was interested, I know you gave your first blush reaction to Jimmy Kimmel, but give them to me, give them to our audience. What did you think of the debate overall?
She did an amazing job in all aspects of the game, as they say, when you talk about football analysis. She was great on offense, but she was also great on putting out her affirmative case. Why she should be president, even apart from how bad Trump is. She was great at transitioning from that to answering criticisms and then to attack, turning things into an attack on Trump. And she didn't do the one thing that I would have done, which was overdone it. Okay, overdoing the attacks on Trump. She did it. She just did it perfectly. Everything was just the right amount and the right pitch. I always like to see more attacks on Trump, the better. But no, she just did exactly the right amount, enough to trigger him, enough to make the point crisply, and then to rise above it all. And I thought, the other thing that I thought was fascinating about this debate as it was happening, and I was taking shots of the television as it was happening, was the split screen. And the split screen was really devastating a few weeks ago to President Biden, because he just had this blank look on his face a lot of the times with his mouth like this, like that while Trump was talking, which is one reasonable reaction to Donald Trump is like, but that was not her. She kept looking right at him like that with the eye and the kind of, you know, but not too much.
Not too much.
It's like she was all of us. Like, oh God, what is he saying now? I can't even understand what he's saying. What the fuck did he just say? And it was just perfect. And it was also, you know, to go back to the body language, and I hate to say the body language is so important, but it actually is. You know, when they went right out on stage, she went right to him, physically occupying his space. Because she's not to show she's not afraid of this guy, right? And the thinking was, you know, he made some crack in a tweet or a Truth Social about, you know, basically that Kamala Harris is short compared to him.
How
dare he? Right? She, you know, she just went right up to him and shook his hand, and he's like, you know, he didn't know what to do with that.
Yeah.
But she said something, I forget what it was, you know, that you could catch on the mic. And it was just basically, I'm not afraid of you. And no, why should she be? He's a fool. He's a clown. There's nothing to be afraid of, which is sort of makes you wonder about basically the entire Republican establishment. But then, you know, and then she kept looking at him during the entire debate, the side look. She watched him while he was spewing out his insanity. And that was critical, because she's not afraid of him. She shows contempt for him in a restrained way. That was a lot of the messaging that occurred. And then he would not look at her. He would just make this sourpuss, like he would just make me sourpuss looks, because he was unhappy. He can't take the heat. He doesn't know how to give it back in any measured, coherent way. And, you know, I mean, if you look at it that way, I mean, that's the visual aspect of it. But if you ever took a transcript of the debate, I'd actually like to print one out. We have one candidate speaking in full sentences and indeed paragraphs that follow one another with logical flow, and then, you know, transition with nice transitions to other subjects when one subject is finished. And we had another guy who was just spouting out words and phrases and lies. Lies about everything. Lies about, lying about people eating cats. Lying about January 6th. Lying about tariffs. Lying about his own personal wealth and where it came from. Literally lying about everything. Lying about Ukraine. Lying about the entire world. But he can, that he can cause peace, even before he's elected president. It's like, okay, why don't you do that now, asshole? and then the other thing, but I did learn something that I did not know before. I'm not sure I'm better off for having learned it. But, he is a leader in fertilization.
Yes, that's right.
A leader in fertilization. I did not know that. I don't know that I want to know that. But I did learn that. That was basically the one thing he taught me during the debate.
Yeah. And that was important information that Americans can use. Going to improve people's lives. And yeah, it matters. Here's the thing that I wanted to circle back with you on, because your point about, you would have done more offense, maybe. It is funny. You and I had, because you and I were both doing TV, we were both doing commentary leading up to the debate, and we had radically different positions on what we thought she should do. You were much more in the, she's got to go at him hard. Like, she's got to rattle him, get under his skin. I was much more in the she needs to be substantive. She needs to talk directly to the American people, act like he's not even there. Just like whatever. What amazed me about her performance.
She did both. Right. No. And I would not say, if we had this discussion beforehand, maybe we did. I would not have disagreed with you. Okay, I absolutely agree. That's part of the program. And there's plenty of opportunity. There's going to be plenty of opportunity for that. At the same time, you have to get under his skin, because he starts chasing every... You let a rabbit loose in the room that he's obsessed with, like crowd size. He's going to go chase the rabbit like a lunatic. And she even brought up Hannibal Lecter. Okay. I mean, that, which was perfect, because then there's a 50% chance he's going to start saying, well, blah, 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 blah. That's my point about asylum and yada, da, da, da. Once you throw this shit out there, his brain goes out and chases it. So she did exactly what she had to do, which is what you were saying and what I was saying. And as far as I'm concerned, it's like, it was amazing how little of it she had to do to get him going.
I genuinely couldn't believe how he went in for that crowd size.
Well, yeah, but the point is, and I think what helps there, and not to toot my horn or anybody else's, I mean, I think the campaign did an amazing job of doing what I've been urging Democrats to do for years, which is just get under his skin. I think the pre-debate prep on that was so effective, she was able to get him to trigger him with a lot less than she otherwise would have. And they had this shit in these signs up in Philadelphia that were hard to miss about crowd size and things. They were running ads in the Philadelphia downtown media market that he would see, because he'd have to spend a couple of hours chilling in a hotel room beforehand, probably, right? Yeah. And so he turned on, the man can't not turn on the TV. He's going to see the ads. And so they did a lot of that. So all of this stuff getting under his nerves made it a lot easier, I think, for her to do it without throwing the kitchen sink at him.
Well, without sinking to his level. Like, what was interesting, because I always worry that, like, Trump, part of the negative thing that Trump does is that he kind of drags people down to his level,
right,
and that he is able to like not face consequences for that. But the people who get brought down to his level do face judgment and consequences. Cause like, there's always been this weird rule where he gets judged entirely outside of normal political rules, but everybody else still gets judged within normal political rules. But somehow she managed to do it in a way that.
Because she's factual. The reason why it's easier to do with him is you're just saying facts. He talks about Hannibal Lecter at his rallies. People do leave during his rallies. We see the videos of people going, blah, blah, blah. They left during his freaking convention speech. It was so bad. And that's why it's easier to do. You don't have to call him dumbass Donald.
Right.
I mean, I like to call him dumbass Donald. That's fine for me, but I'm not running for president.
Sure.
And she didn't have to do that. She just, all she has to do is, it doesn't take much to throw him off the scent. No, she just did it perfectly. They thought this through exactly. They thought this through very, very well, the debate prep team. And I remember thinking, you know, we had this discussion right after, before or after the first debate. And it's like, I mean, let's leave apart the age issue. I just didn't feel like they prepped Biden properly. I remember thinking, like, you have to go and you have to throw little jabs in his direction. And then, and the thing that I also think that bothered me is they didn't try to provoke him before the debate. I would have taken out, you know, I would have done what basically the Harris campaign did it exactly by the book, the way it should have been done the first time. I don't know whether it would have worked with Biden. He was having a bad night that night. But we should be all grateful that he did, I guess, because now we're in such a much better circumstance than we were at the end of June. God help us.
Yeah, it's a good thing some people were really urging him to step aside.
Yeah, some people. Yeah.
So wait, actually, on the you talked about the body language. I got into a fight with Frank Luntz on Twitter, which obviously I shouldn't do, argue with people on Twitter. But Frank Luntz, he tweeted out something to the effect of, Kamala Harris is winning on substance, but she's losing with her body language. And he kind of included a clip of her, you know, sort of making, you said it, sort of making the, like,
this look.
The, like, what WTF eyes at him. And here's the thing. I got to say, I was on guard. I do think voters react to this. Voters react to, and I think judge women more harshly for what they would deem to be sort of unserious. Like, I think women have like a slightly harder time clearing in some people's minds, like the presidential bar. And one of the things that knocks them down is when they look, their facial expressions seem like maybe overly dramatic or something like that. And so I was worried about that for her.
Yeah. But
I actually did not think, so I got into a fight with him over it though, because I was like, no, she's not. Like, she's not hurting herself with this, because her face was all of us listening to Donald Trump rant like a deranged lunatic about they're eating pets. Like, what's she supposed to do with her face? And I'll tell you, and this is one of the reasons why I liked the constant look of incredulity, is that if you are otherwise just staring at the camera or just looking at him normally, it's almost like it's like, oh yeah, this guy's just saying normal stuff here.
You're valid.
No, he's not.
It's very tricky. And you're absolutely right that there is a double standard, a double gender-based standard.
Because what about Trump's face? Trump was sitting there like this. Yeah, what? His face was, he looked awful. Go ahead.
He always looks awful. But there's more than that going on. And one of the big advantages, I'm just going to throw this out, that Kamala Harris had, and I don't even think she probably needed, you know, coaching on this. She's a fucking trial lawyer.
Yeah.
Okay. And the thing they tell you, that you're told from the moment you pass the bar and you're wet behind the ears, is don't make faces in the courtroom. Okay. Particularly when there's a jury, because they will take it the wrong way. You're supposed to be poker faced the entire time. That is sort of like a general rule that you should follow, because it's the safest way to proceed. It's also like in court, the other thing they tell you in court is don't use humor unless you know what you're doing. Don't make a joke with the judge unless you know exactly what you're doing. Okay, unless you have perfect sense of comedy and know the judge and feel comfortable in the environment. You know, the best thing to do is to stay poker-faced. But good lawyers don't have to do that. The best lawyers, people who are the most experienced, will save the moment for the moment where they'll give a very slight, subtle look when they hear a witness for the other side saying something really insane. You know, not obnoxious. Enough for the jury to see. The jury watches everybody. The jury there is watching the lawyers for their reaction. And the less you react, the better, because when you do react in a very slight fashion, they'll say, "Oh, okay, I like this guy. He doesn't overdo it, but I see what he's thinking right here." It's kind of like an internal way to communicate with a low-level way to communicate. And that's essentially what she was doing with the American people. She didn't overdo it, okay? And it's hard, it's actually a little bit hard to overdo with Trump because he's so fucking insane. Now, Luntz is right in the sense that there are going to be people who are just going to say, "Oh, look at her, what a bitch. She's making faces at our president."
Do you think he'd debate her again?
My immediate assumption was no after the debate. But then I've actually heard that there's a suggestion that they might want another debate. And if they do, it's because they're fucking desperate.
Yeah. Yeah. Should she give it to him if he wants it?
I think it would be hard to say no.
Yeah, me too.
Because they'll go out and just say, "Oh, Kamala's afraid to come back to debate us." It's like, her position has to be anytime, anywhere, dude.
Yeah, I agree.
Because you're nothing.
Hey, I got to ask. So here's where we're going to get legal adjacent more.
This wasn't legal adjacent?
No, that was legal adjacent. This is what's great about it being Kamala, is that everything's prosecutor/legal adjacent.
Exactly.
But do you think, so she did hit him a little bit on his criminal convictions. Do you think she did enough of that? Should she have done more of it? Like, what do you think?
I wouldn't have minded a little bit more. But again, as I think we talked about this in Austin, she's got to be careful because, you know, she's going to be the president of the United States who is going to be in charge of two of these four prosecutions. So she did, you know, she mentioned the 34 criminal counts he was convicted on. And she also mentioned, which is, you know, this is where the risky part is, the some of the federal cases, the other charges. And that's a little bit tricky for her because, again, she's going to be president of the United States. And you know, it's going to be her attorney general, whoever that is, prosecuting these cases. But she didn't go into them too much. She went back into January 6th. She did it perfectly, I thought. And I wouldn't have minded a little bit more. He's an adjudicated rapist and a convicted felon. I can't get enough of that. But, you know, I have a feeling that from other sources, we will be hearing more about his sexual abuse. And we're going to hear more about the criminal convictions pretty soon. It's plenty of time left.
Yeah, I do think where she said, when she said, "And we especially don't want Donald Trump making decisions about what women's bodies," like, I felt like that it held the adjudicated rapist like stuff in it without, like, that is where she had sort of, like, I thought a light touch in a way, though, that still, like, put it out there.
Yeah, no, I think it's great. You know, look, I mean, it's still September.
Okay? Yeah.
It's not even mid-September yet. Well, it's sort of mid-September, but we haven't reached September 15th yet. There's a lot of time left. Okay. So you don't need to get everything in 90 minutes. And that was, again, that was another aspect of her preparation that I thought was effective. It's like, you don't have to get everything in. You pick your spots. And, you know, the guy told literally dozens of lies in just the first half hour. I was starting to make a list of just the general topic areas where he told multiple lies about. And Vice President Harris did a great job of not, you can't just say he just lied. Here are the following 16 lies he just told. You just can't do that in a debate, right? And I think part of the problem that President Biden had back in June was, he's listening to these lies and he's like, check, these lie. And you can see the process in his brain. How am I going to respond to each of the 25 lies I heard in the last 15 seconds? And you can't do that. You're short circuit. Whether you're 80 years old or whether you're 60 years old or whether you're 40 years old, if you start trying to do that, you will malprocess the information. And she was just perfect. You don't have to get everything in. You pick your spots. You transition to something positive, and then you go out and attack them again. This is something I learned from appellate arguments. You should be able to basically write your most important points down on two sheets of paper.
Yeah.
And then when you if you learn what's on those pieces of paper and the three word versions of everything, there's going to be paragraphs and paragraphs that you will know that you could go into if you wanted to. But then you could also say these three words on this side of the page connect over here, and you start learning all the linkages between all the different points that you want to make. And it makes for a seamless presentation. And that's how she prepared. She had it all, you know, right there in front of her. And she was, you know, she knows how to do this as a trial lawyer. And she was obviously, she spent several very productive days. And with a great stand-in, my friend, my very good friend, Philippe Raines was apparently the...
He played Donald Trump
played
in the
Donald
paper.
Trump as he did in 2016 with Hillary. It's funny. It's like all my friends, I have all these friends who are like Hillaryites. It's crazy. And he's a good friend of mine. And I want to figure out how much will that tie that he wore, the red tie that he wore, to sell on eBay. That's what...
all right. This isn't even really debate related, but I guess... One of the things that your point about there's only so much you can talk about, but I have been surprised, and I wonder if you have too, how little the Supreme Court has come up as like a dominant issue. Because for Republicans, right, like I listen to Republicans all the time when they justify voting for Donald Trump, making it about the Supreme Court, right? And that is a real motivator for a lot of conservatives is who controls the court.
I think Donald Trump would not have won the 2016 presidential election if Antonin Scalia, when he went to that Texas ranch in February of 2016, had put on his CPAP mask. Honest to God. I think that made a big difference in people's, including my willingness to say, yes, I'll vote for Donald Trump, even though I don't think he's not my favorite candidate and he's off. I think that made a big difference in 2016.
Yeah, so why don't Dems make it a bigger issue now?
Because it's a different kind of thing. It's in 2016, what was at issue was who gets that seat, which is normal, okay? And except for the fact that the Republicans basically held the seat open for a year, which was not normal.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're talking about now isn't any particular seat on the Supreme Court. It's basically the structure of the Supreme Court. And people are understandably squeamish about changing the manner in which the Supreme Court operates. History wrote a very negative review of FDR's court packing plan. So anything you try to do to the court that involves not something more than appointing justices that you like is tricky. And the particular proposal that the Biden administration has made, I haven't read it in all its details. I probably should, but you know, every time you read something, a plan in all its details, by the time it gets to actual legislation, it's going to look different. But you know, it's hard to explain what's the difference between that and court packing and other things. It's complicated. I do think she made a very effective use of the Supreme Court's immunity decision when she basically said,
well,
the Supreme Court has said this, you don't want this guy to be president with that being the rule.
Yeah.
And I thought that was very effective and very true.
Wait, but hold on. Don't you think that Thomas and Alito will retire if Trump wins?
Yes.
I mean, can't they make a big deal out of the two seats? I hear what you're saying
because the flip side is they might not resign. They'll try to stay another 4 years if Harris wins. So you don't really get a benefit. You avoid having a 40-year-old Alito or 40-year-old Thomas replacement. It's a little too convoluted. If you want to talk about the Supreme Court and you're a Democrat, you just tag him with Dobbs.
She brought it up.
Right. It's Dobbs. You want more Dobbs? You want, you know, here, vote for this guy. Because he's the guy who gave it to you. And then, you know, Trump goes on his absolute insane lie that everybody wanted Roe overruled. Like, you know, I'm a somebody who read Roe v. Wade for the first time as a senior in college in 1984 and thought it was wrongly decided and a ridiculous decision. But I would never, ever, I could never assert that everybody agreed with me. When I first took that course in con law in 1984 in college, Archibald Cox, a liberal, agreed with me. Lots of liberals did agree at that time that Roe was kind of, okay? But it's just not true that everybody wanted Roe to go overruled. I wouldn't even have overruled Roe if I were on the Supreme Court.
Well, no, because at this point now, precedents, yeah.
I mean, not, I, you know, there's just precedent out there that you look at and you just say, what were these people thinking in 1892? But it's just not worth trying to fix, okay?
All right. We're going to talk a little bit more about some of the issues around the Supreme Court on the other half of this, but...
This show is sponsored by Hexclad. You know, my kitchen is full of stainless steel pans that are hard to clean and nonstick pans that you have to replace like every 6 months. That is, it was full of those things until we found Hexclad, which is a staple when we're cooking. They are fantastic. I am a big egg and pancake maker. Big pancake maker. That's like dinner 7 or 8 nights a week in my house, George. The kids will often with the old pans, cut them up, scratch them, nick them when they go to butter the pans. Not the Hexclad. They last for forever. You see that old pan that's haunting your kitchen? It's time to give yourself what you really want. Hexclad's pans are easy to clean, dishwasher safe, and simple to wipe clean after use. They're oven safe, handling heat up to 500 degrees. Hexclad products also come with a lifetime warranty. They literally last a lifetime, and they're toxin-free. Hexclad isn't just about pots and pans. Their knives are made of 67 layers of Japanese Damascus steel for a sharper edge that stays sharp longer for effortless slicing. Gordon Ramsay uses Hexclad in his restaurants and his home. You guys all know that he is not easily impressed. For a limited time only, our listeners get 10% off your order with our exclusive link. Just head to hexclad.com/askgeorge. Support our show and check them out at hexclad.com/askgeorge. Make sure to let them know that we sent you. Bon appetit. Let's eat with Hexclad's revolutionary cookware.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
You can use the F word on Kimmel. I didn't realize that.
It's late at night, I guess.
It's
I think they loosened
they
it up.
They bleep it. And I was like, wait a minute. Did I just hear that? Because I was like, the guy used the F word. I was in the dressing room. And of course, they bleep it. But he was it was like a skip beforehand. Hmm. And then when I went out to the producer, the producer took me out to the stage. He told me, don't use the F word too much because we don't have as much time tonight to bleep it.
Like the editors didn't have the time.
Because normally they shoot it like 2 hours earlier than they did the night I was on last night or the night before. I don't even remember now. It was last night. Jesus. No, the night before. Because of the debate. So they basically they were finishing up the taping of the show almost as it was about to go on to the East Coast because they shoot it live to tape. And the guy literally told me, don't use the F word so much because we don't have much time to take it out.
Did you accommodate that?
I did. I think I used the word frick.
Frick. Well, that, you know, don't have to beep that. All right. So listen, I have this topic that's a little bit of a point of personal privilege because it's something that I'm annoyed about. And I don't know if you caught this because I want to talk about an op-ed in the Washington Post this week from Ramesh Panruhu.
I love Ramesh.
I thought you might. And so I got to say,
Ramesh and I go back a long way. I went to Ramesh's wedding way long ago. He's such a sweetheart. But he was like 12 when he started writing. Remember that?
No, because I'm even younger than he is.
Oh, that's crazy. No, like when he first started writing, I mean, he's really freaking smart. It was like, How old is this kid? He must have been like 12. It's
crazy. No, I've always really liked Ramesh, and I think he's sort of the last sane person at NRO. Yep. That's not true. They've added a couple voices, but like generally speaking, Rich Lowry's like completely in Trump sycophancy world. But Ramesh is all right. But he wrote a piece that made me want to throw my computer out of a window that I wanted to ask you about. Because it was about the Liz Cheney endorsement. And he was essentially saying, all right, Liz, you made the case against Donald Trump, but you didn't make a case for Harris. And it doesn't make any sense you're endorsing her because she is also a threat to the Constitution and to the rule of law. And so he says this. He basically says that it's because of the dangerous changes that Democrats want to make to the Supreme Court. So it is this thing you were talking about before with whether it was term limits or court packing or any of this discussion. So he says this. Supreme Court reforms would be radical and dangerous changes in our form of government. Someone with a conservative view of the Constitution, as Cheney insists she is, should also be alarmed by the goal of this change, the destruction of the court's conservative supermajority. Even if that goal were pursued by normal means, such as judicial appointments, most conservatives rightly find it inimical to the Constitution. And then he goes on to say, it is always possible that a President Kamala Harris would not really try to oust judges who disagree with her or that a Republican Senate would restrain her. But Trump apologists have offered similar assurances about his risks. And the point of Cheney's argument was to provide something more than just a difference of degree of danger between them. And besides, she is also campaigning for Democratic senators. The tragedy of this election for conservatives and everyone else is that Cheney's case against Trump is strong, but her case for Harris isn't. I was pretty annoyed at this piece because I find the conflation or the equivalence.
Yeah, no, it's another false equivalence. I mean, literally, NRO has dined off ever since that issue where they said Trump was horrible and don't even consider voting for Trump.
They have the against Trump issue.
The against Trump issue, the famous one. And ever since then, basically, they have subsisted on false equivalences. And basically, all the never Trumpers and all the Trumpers have subsisted on false equivalencies. And yes, you can all, you know, there are things that Democrats have done and do from time to time that I do not believe are in the best interests of the rule of law. Okay. I can see that. That's one of the reasons why I was a conservative. But there, you know, it's not as though there isn't an order of magnitude and the question of good faith that come into play. Okay. Like Donald Trump openly, you know, the Democrats may be misguided sometimes on what they think is consistent with the rule of law, okay? But they're not actively seeking to destroy it for political advantage the way Donald Trump is. That's one point. And the second point, to go more specifically about what Ramesh was saying about the Supreme Court, is, you know, I fundamentally don't want to interfere with the independence of the courts. I am absolutely dead set against that. Okay. And that goes to the core of my being, even when the courts do things that are stupid and wrong, including Roe, including the immunity decision. It's like, you know, we have to respect the Supreme Court's decisions. But that being said, to equate messing around with the Supreme Court in a way that doesn't actually take away its independence, and then putting the executive branch, Article 2, the man in charge or woman charged with executing the laws of the United States, and taking that and divorcing it from the rule of law is a wholly different thing. I mean, there's a reason. There was a famous book written by one of the greatest constitutional law scholars of all time. And it was called The Least Dangerous Branch, which is a quote from actually the Federalist paper, when Hamilton, I think it was, number 78, talked about the Supreme Court as the least dangerous branch. And it is the least dangerous. So the judiciary is the least dangerous. It doesn't command armies. Okay? It can't command mobs because they're not elected and they can't be demagogues the way, say, a president who talks about a stolen election could be. Okay. The dangers of us of messing with the Supreme Court, which there are, you know, I absolutely express concern about that, are nothing compared to turning over the executive branch to a wannabe authoritarian fascist lunatic. It's just orders of magnitude different. And, you know, again, to go back to the criticisms of the Biden Harris proposed changes to the Supreme Court and how it sits. Look, the fact of the matter is the Constitution does not say very much about the Supreme Court other than the Supreme Court and judges who are Article III judges who are appointed for the lower courts, which Congress is free to create or not create. Because the Constitution only creates the Supreme Court. Doesn't say how many justices it should have. It does somewhere else say that there has to be a chief justice. And other than giving
and them lifetime appointments,
other than giving them lifetime appointments during periods of good behavior, that's all it says. So it doesn't tell you whether you should have 5, 9, 10, 15 judges on the Supreme Court. That doesn't mean we should be, you know, that we want somebody to pull an FDR and say, let's appoint nine liberals to the Supreme Court to balance the, you know, what we've got now. But it could mean that you could end up with you could do some kind of a system like they have on the courts of appeals, which is you've got courts of appeals with, like in New York, 13 judges, in California, 39 judges. They sit in panels of three because you can't have them all sitting at once. You could have, you know, 15 judges on the Supreme Court and the youngest nine sit. If somebody has to recuse themselves because they own, you know, Acme stock, well, then one of the older people can come in and sit. It would solve that recusal problem. And they would all be justices until they decided they wanted to go work at Jones Day or retire or whatever. There's nothing constitutional in the Constitution that says that Congress could not regulate the Supreme Court in that way.
So, I don't actually love the idea of judges then going off and working at Jones Day and or any other place that they could be incentivized to be kind to during their tenure while they're on the Supreme Court.
But, you know, I mean, look, the answer to that is to pay judges more. But, you know, I mean, I'm not going to cite any examples here, you know, of people like who got free recreational vehicles from other people. But, you know, I mean, a lot of the judges I talk to about that circumstance of a certain Supreme Court justice who remains blameless, who has accepted millions of dollars of gifts, is it's like, I know a guy who left the bench because basically he couldn't afford to pay his bills. He went off to become a lawyer at a place that paid him a lot of money. And that's like, if you it's okay. It's like, if you don't want to commit to that life, you should have that option.
Yeah. Okay? Here's the thing.
Okay. But the way to solve the problem is to pay the justices more. You don't want, you know, and make sure they, you know, because the alternative is this corruption this is the real corruption is having, or the appearance of corruption is having judges take while they're on the bench.
I want to contrast Ramesh's piece with Alberto Gonzalez, who just published an op-ed today in Politico endorsing Harris. And Gonzalez also acknowledged concerns about Supreme Court reform proposals, which I would just say I share. But he has a clear-eyed analysis of Trump's threat to the rule of law. And he says this: any discussion about fidelity to the rule of law has to include Trump's 34 state felony convictions, his state civil financial judgment of libel based on sexual abuse, as well as the pending federal elections interference case, not to mention the recently dismissed federal documents case that the special counsel Jack Smith is continuing to pursue. Standing alone, these charges, convictions, and judgments show that Trump is someone who fails to act time and time again in accordance with the rule of law. There is little evidence that he has the integrity and character to responsibly wield the power of the presidency within the limits of the law. And no amount of rationalization to support Trump because of his policies can overcome the disqualification of this man based on his lack of integrity. And I'll just finish with this one last part where he says, there are many lawyers who served in Republican administrations who share my concern about the Republican nominee. All of us in the legal profession have a special obligation to abide by and to protect the rule of law. It is part of our oath to support the Constitution. We are not only champions for the poor and the innocent, we are also guardians of the system that protects our personal freedoms. I thought that was...
It was beautiful. Yeah, I mean, I cannot... I cannot shower enough praise on Attorney General Gonzalez and how outspoken he has been over the past several years about Donald Trump. I only wish his former boss would follow suit. Alberto Gonzalez is a true patriot. He is, you know, and that was just what he just expressed there. I think as eloquently as I've heard expresses why we need, you know, we need groups like Society for the Rule of Law. We need lawyers to speak up as much as anyone. And, you know, I mean, it just brings, it almost brings tears to my eyes. I'm really, really, really just in awe of Alberto Gonzalez and his faithfulness to the cause of a free and robust democracy under the rule of law.
Yeah, well, I appreciate what I think in his mind was actually a direct response to conservatives who make the kind of arguments, with all due respect to Ramesh. I think his argument is deeply flawed and rooted in a kind of tribal need to take a stand somewhere to say that, to try to create an equivalency where there isn't one. And I appreciate that Gonzalez felt like he made a direct answer to that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's a question of orders of magnitude of danger.
Yeah. Not even in the same solar system.
This show is sponsored by HexClad. You know, my kitchen is full of stainless steel pans that are hard to clean and nonstick pans that you have to replace like every 6 months. That is, it was full of those things until we found HexClad, which is a staple when we're cooking. They are fantastic. I am a big egg and pancake maker. Big pancake maker. That's like dinner 7 or 8 nights a week in my house, George. The kids will often with the old pans, cut them up, scratch them, nick them when they go to butter the pans. Not the HexClad. They last for forever. You see that old pan that's haunting your kitchen? It's time to give yourself what you really want. HexClad's pans are easy to clean, dishwasher safe, and simple to wipe clean after use. They're oven safe, handling heat up to 500 degrees. HexClad products also come with a lifetime warranty. They literally last a lifetime, and they're toxin-free. HexClad isn't just about pots and pans. Their knives are made of 67 layers of Japanese Damascus steel for a sharper edge that stays sharp longer for effortless slicing. Gordon Ramsay uses HexClad in his restaurants and his home. You guys all know that he is not easily impressed. For a limited time only, our listeners get 10% off your order with our exclusive link. Just head to hexclad.com/askgeorge. Support our show and check them out at hexclad.com/askgeorge. Make sure to let them know that we sent you. Bon appetit. Let's eat with HexClad's revolutionary cookware.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Okay. Just to wrap up as we go into the final stretch of this pod here, George, last time we recorded, we were in Austin at the Texas Tribune Festival, and the audience, like I said at the top, they weren't as interested in our in-depth analysis on all the legal stuff. So we did some of the case roundups, but not a lot. But one thing I wanted to ask you about is the differing approaches to the case timelines by Judge Merchant and Judge Chutkan. I wanted to put something in here for the real legal nerds. So in the D.C. hearing last week, Judge Chutkan said that she's not considering the presidential election in her briefing schedule. Trump's lawyer talked about the context of the scheduling, and Judge Chutkan, she said something like, you're talking about a presidential election, and I'm talking about a four-count indictment. And so she's basically, you know, not taking the election into consideration. But Judge Marchand took a different approach and acknowledged that this was a unique time frame, meaning the time frame up here until the election. And so he postponed everything until after the November election. So in some ways, the result is the same, because even though the D.C. election interference case is going to be briefed in September and October, there won't be a factual hearing until after the election. But I just want to know, like, what do you think? Like, who's right in there? Like, which is the right thing to do?
I think Judge Chutkan has the right approach.
Okay.
But basically, because once you start thinking about political considerations, you become political. Okay. Once you start thinking, well, I do it now before it gets too hot, or later before after it cools off. Once you start making those calculations, you're making yourself, you're turning yourself into a political actor one way or the other. Okay. And it's not even clear what exactly it is you are trying to help or hurt or prevent. I mean, what is it? You're preventing people from learning information about one of the candidates, or are you preventing undue influence? I mean, it's not a calculation that judges are capable of making or should be making. And so I prefer Judge Chutkan's approach. If it's, you know, if I would schedule in some other case a brief to be due in 4 weeks or a hearing to be due to occur in 4 weeks, I'm going to schedule that unless the parties have some kind of a good excuse that they, you know, they have a conflicting date or whatever. I would do it the way I normally do it in other cases. And that's the Chutkan approach, and I approve of that. In Marchand's case, I judges have so much discretion when it comes to scheduling, because they have their own schedule. Because it's like they get to set their own schedules, unlike the rest of us. They get to say, okay, I decided, you know, I'm going to take the week of August 16th off. I mean, they can do that. Judges don't do that irresponsibly and leaving parties in the lurch, but they can control their own schedules. And I just think that, you know, if he really just wanted to put it off, he has plenty of other reasons to want to put it off. He doesn't need to go out and try to, you know, and try to explain on political grounds why he's putting something off. A justice in the Supreme Court of the state of New York has so big caseload. He could have just put this off without saying anything. Just like, you know, I'm putting it off. I got other things to do. I guess I should credit him for being honest about it, but I just don't think, you know, writing that down and expressing that as a legitimate basis for scheduling a criminal sentencing, I find that I don't like it. But that said, I mean, I hesitate to criticize Justice Marchand, because he has, you know, he's the guy who actually tried a case. He's the guy who actually went full bore ahead and took this case and tried it in the middle of an election year. He's not a fearful guy. I admire his courage. He's been, you know, he's had the defendant basically attack his family, and I admire Justice Marchand to no end. I just wish he hadn't done what he did here. If he was going to put it off, just put it off. I mean, there's plenty of reasons to put things off without having to say it was because of an election.
Yeah, I agree with that. And without knowing nearly as much about it, I agree. Look, George, thanks so much, man.
Thank you, as always.
Explaining the legal news to me and everything else. It's almost like this show is called George Conway Explains It All. Hey guys, don't forget to hit subscribe, leave us a review, email us at askgeorge@thebulwark.com, and we will see you guys next week. Bye.
Well, George Conway, he's a man with a plan. Got to sit down with Sarah Longwell, take a stand, explain all the legal problems they're piling high. With Donald Trump, oh my, oh my, oh my. He said, Sarah, let me break it down for you. There's obstruction of justice, corruption too. The legal tangles and troubles, they're growing fast. It's a storm that's gonna last and last. Oh, Conway, tell him well about it. Those legal problems can't live without it. From the Emoluments to the Russian ties. Listen close.
Tourist golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.